ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 8th of May. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Humanitarian groups say Israel's seizure of their main border crossing into Gaza means most Palestinians in the besieged territory have been cut off from aid. Israeli military seized the Rafah border crossing with Egypt yesterday after the Islamist group Hamas accepted a ceasefire proposal to end the fighting in Gaza. Aid groups say they're running out of fuel and won't be able to provide water to displaced people inside Gaza unless Israel reopens the crossing immediately. From Jerusalem, Eric Torchek reports.
Fearful of an Israeli invasion, displaced Palestinians are dismantling the makeshift shelters that have been their homes in southern Gaza for the past few months. They're taking the foraged pieces of wood and plastic further north, where they believe they might be safe from the Israeli military. We will move. We will look for somewhere safe, this woman, Fida Shalah, says. We don't even know where this safe place is exactly. I don't see there is any place safe. These people rely on aid from United Nations agencies to survive. But the UN says Israel has closed all the crossings in southern Gaza, meaning it's running out of fuel, food and water. Displaced Palestinian Mahdi al-Tarabin understands the significance of that. This is death, he says. The shutting of the border is the end for us. The Israeli military says 60 aid trucks entered the north of Gaza through a newly opened crossing. But that aid is for the people in the north, not a resupply for the UN in the south. Jens Lerke from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, which oversees relief efforts in Gaza, says it's a desperate situation.
Currently, the two main arteries for getting aid into Gaza is currently choked off. Indeed, this morning is one of the darkest in this seven-month-long nightmare.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the military was told to enter Rafah against international objections, even though Hamas had accepted a ceasefire deal. The Hamas proposal yesterday was intended to prevent the entry of our forces into Rafah, he says. It did not happen. As the war cabinet unanimously determined, the Hamas proposal is very far from Israel's necessary requirements. Israel will not allow Hamas to restore its evil rule in the Gaza Strip. Israel has sent what it calls a mid-level negotiating team to Cairo to discuss the ceasefire proposal with Hamas. A new poll yesterday found a majority of Israelis think a ceasefire is more important than attacking Rafah. Palestinians hope those Israelis can convince their government. Mohammed Najjar, a 23-year-old student in Rafah, says he thinks the Israeli invasion of his city is a political move and won't block a ceasefire being signed. There are a lot of clashes, he says. I believe that Netanyahu is doing all that to please the right wing of his party and it will be limited. There are 2 million Gazans and many Israeli families hoping he's right. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Torchek reporting for AM.
Stormy Daniels, the key prosecution witness in Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial in New York City, has given evidence. The adult film star has given explicit details about an alleged sexual encounter with Mr. Trump in 2006 and the process of negotiating a payment from the ex-president's fixer, Michael Cohen, to keep her silent about it. Emily Gromantz is from our North America Bureau. Emily, what did Stormy Daniels say about the encounter?
Well, this evidence was extraordinarily detailed. In fact, it was so detailed that at times the judge, Warren Moshan, reprimanded the prosecution for soliciting too much detail and prompted Stormy Daniels to give simpler evidence a bit more to the point. She talked about meeting Donald Trump at Lake Tahoe in 2006. She says she was invited to dinner with Mr. Trump via his bodyguard, and when she arrived at his hotel suite, he greeted her wearing satin pyjamas, though then changed into a dress shirt and pants after she said she made a Hugh Hefner joke about the pyjamas. Ms. Daniel said they spoke for a few hours. She'd asked him about his then new wife, Melania, who'd just given birth to their son, Baron. And at various times she said she'd called him pompous and arrogant. Ms. Daniel's evidence was that she went to the bathroom because she'd drunk several bottles of water while they'd been talking. And when she came out, Mr. Trump was blocking the door to the exit. She described beginning to feel that she'd misread the situation. She described a feeling of blacking out, although she was firm that she wasn't insinuating that she'd been drugged or anything like that. She then told the court the two of them had sex, which Mr. Trump has always denied. She said she kept in contact with him over the next couple of years. There was the prospect of her being cast on the reality show Celebrity Apprentice, but they eventually lost touch. And then before the 2016 election, she began to want her story out there. But as part of that process of trying to tell that story, she was then contacted and eventually negotiated a $130,000, about $200,000 payment to keep the story from becoming public. And that's the alleged wrongdoing at the heart of this case. It's related to that money made to Ms. Daniels in order, the prosecution says, to bury this story as Mr. Trump was contesting the 2016 election.
The defence was outraged at part of Ms. Daniels' evidence. Why?
Well, I mentioned Ms. Daniels had been pulled up a couple of times by the judge, Warren Marchand. Mr. Trump's lawyers returned from the break and argued, in fact, that it should be a mistrial. They, in effect, were arguing that the detail in her story was overstepping, that it was in parts designed purely to embarrass Mr. Trump and was not related to the substance of the prosecution's alleged charges against Mr. Trump. One of the lawyers asked the judge, how can we come back from this in a way that's fair to President Trump? And Judge Marchand declined to grant the mistrial, but said the remedy would come through cross-examination, which started after lunch. So far, we've seen some quite combative questioning of Ms. Daniels by Mr. Trump's defence team. For example, the lawyer has put to Stormy Daniels that this story has made her quite a lot of money. And Ms. Daniels countered, saying that it's also cost her a lot of money.
Emily Gramance there. The parents of the two Perth brothers murdered in Mexico say the world's become a much darker place, but they've urged others to live bigger, shine brighter, and love harder in their memory. Deborah and Martin Robinson travelled to the Mexican city of Ensenada to identify their sons, Jake and Callum, and now take them home. Police say it appears the brothers and their American friend, Jack Rode, were murdered and dumped in a well. North America correspondent Carrington Clark has been closely following this story and joins us from Baja, California. Carrington, the Robinson family spoke with the media a short time ago in San Diego. What did they say?
Yeah, after what must have been just a week of unimaginable horror for this family, after their two sons, Callum and Jake, first went missing in Mexico and subsequently were discovered to have been murdered along with their friend Carter Rode. We did hear today from Deborah and Martin Robinson. They were on a beach in San Diego, just around the corner from where Callum was most recently living. He lived in America for about a decade and described it as a second home. They started by thanking people for their words of support, but really the focus was on trying to remember, as they put it, their beautiful boys.
It is with heavy hearts that we share the news that Callum Jake have been murdered. Our hearts are broken, and the world has become a darker place for us. Now it's time to bring them home to family and friends and the ocean waves in Australia. Please, live bigger, shine brighter, and love harder in their memory.
So that was Deborah speaking on behalf of herself and her husband, Martin. He was there by her side and had previously thanked both the government and government agencies for all the help that they've given them during this horrific week.
Carrington, tell us where we're up to in the criminal investigation into these murders.
So previously we'd had one Mexican national charged with what's called a forced disappearance. That was before the three bodies had been formally identified. We are expecting him, his name is Jesus Moreno, also known as El Cacas, to appear in court tomorrow for the first time. And we are expecting the crimes that he's charged with to be upgraded to murder. We're still not certain whether or not other people will be charged in connection with these horrific acts. We know that both his brother and his romantic partner had been arrested at the same time, but they had just been charged with drug offences. But the Attorney General here in Baja California had suggested that she believes that more people have to have been responsible for these murders. Now, there is a major question mark here regarding whether or not cartels are part of this mystery, given the high cartel activity here in Baja California. But really, the focus today on the family and on Deborah and Martin, who are now putting together the logistics to get the bodies of their sons home.
North America correspondent Carrington Clark. Migrant communities say the federal government's not showing any appetite to address their concerns about proposed sweeping immigration changes. While not opposed to the principle of the bill, migrant community leaders and the coalition say they're worried about the scope of the minister's powers and lack of clarity on who it applies to. Here's political reporter Nicole Hegarty.
The federal government's rushed attempt in March to legislate new powers to make it easier to deport non-citizens sparked immediate concern from migrant communities, refugee and human rights advocates, and lawyers. It was described as incompatible with human rights, unfair, and unjust. Migrant community leaders say the government's approach since has only exacerbated those concerns.
There has been no serious consideration of the community's concerns.
Benny Bowl is the president of the Queensland African Communities Council.
There's a whole range of concerns, and I haven't seen any changes that have been actually made.
Labor's bill, which passed the lower house before being referred off to committee in the Senate, would require non-citizens to assist authorities in their deportation or face a jail sentence of up to 5 years. The immigration minister would also be given powers to effectively ban people from certain countries from applying for visas with few exemptions. Here's Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill in March defending the reform.
The ASF 17 case does show that it is important that we have these powers. It's not the only reason why we're doing this, though. It is very important that the Australian government move towards running a more orderly migration system.
That High Court case relates to an Iranian man who has refused to cooperate with efforts to deport him, citing fears he'll be persecuted. A decision on that case will be made on Friday. But the coalition also has problems with Labor's bill. It's used a Senate committee dissenting report to lay out a series of amendments it says are needed to improve it. While supporting the intent of the policy, the opposition argues it lacks clarity as well as checks and balances. Liberal Senator Paul Scar is the committee's deputy chair.
We think it's really important to narrow down the scope of the bill and make it absolutely clear that these extraordinary powers, which would apply mandatory minimum criminal penalties, only apply in situations where people have genuinely exhausted all avenues to stay in Australia.
The coalition has also criticised the government's disregard for certain ethnic communities. So instead, it wants the immigration minister to consider the impact of designating a country or pausing visa applications on diaspora communities ahead of making a decision. It also wants those bans or pauses to expire after 3 years.
Nicole Hegarty reporting there. The latest national data shows youth crime is rising for the first time in more than a decade. The statistical analysis also shows recidivism, or re-offending, is increasing as well. As national regional reporter Erin Park explains, experts are wrestling with how best to deal with children who are both offenders and victims.
For Philomena Lewis, the issue of youth crime is personal.
Some of us elderly Indigenous people, we are very angry about it, and we are very surprised, actually, because it's mainly older Indigenous children doing breaking and enterings, stealing vehicles, burning vehicles. It makes it very hard.
The Nyulnyul woman lives in Broome in northern Western Australia, and like many northern residents, she's sick and tired of vandalism and break-ins. While she believes there are issues with aggressive policing and poor performance by government agencies, the community elder says parenting lies at the core of the problem.
Sometimes the parents ask their elder kids to babysit the little ones so they can go down the pub or card game and just leave the children at home. And sometimes this is where kids, they just take off and start drinking and smoking marijuana and housebreaking and all that. There are good parents out there, but the ones who are being selfish towards themselves and not thinking about their children, no, That's not on.
It's a vexed social issue right across the nation. And now the latest data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics suggests youth crime is on the increase. A snapshot of the last 15 years shows the number of 10 to 17-year-olds being dealt with by police has been reducing. But that trend changed in the last financial year, with the rate of children and teenagers being arrested increasing 6% in 2022-2023. Meanwhile, recidivism has also been steadily increasing over the past 15 years. Criminologist Terry Goldsworthy from Bond University is not surprised.
I think there is a youth crime problem because the volume of offending by youth offenders is increasing. The overall unique offender numbers decline, but you're seeing repetitive offending increasing through hardcore offenders who are out there committing more and more serious crime.
Dr. Goldsworthy was a policeman for almost 30 years. He says governments across the country too often take a scattergun approach to the problem, wasting money on novelty solutions that are not properly thought through or evaluated. And he believes a national evidence-based approach is needed.
You could look at, okay, well, what stops the offending in the short term protects the community, and then how do we fix this long term? And they're not necessarily mutually exclusive.
Others are clear a tough-on-crime approach is not the solution. WA Children's Commissioner Jacqueline McGowan-Jones says youth crime is a symptom of a broader problem with poverty, and recidivism won't stop until the deeper, more difficult issues of disadvantage are addressed.
It is absolutely heartbreaking. What we are doing is making them more likely to become lifelong criminals and re-enter the system right throughout their adult years.
Western Australian Children's Commissioner Jacqueline McGowan-Jones ending that report by Erin Park. While the Reserve Bank Board left interest rates on hold yesterday, it's changed its forecast for inflation, saying while it's going down, it's declining at a much slower rate than previously forecast, meaning that interest rates will be higher for longer. The bank's also keeping all options on the table, meaning it might even lift rates again to quell inflation. The bank knows people are hurting. Data shows unprecedented falls in retail spending. As John Daly reports, small businesses are worried.
Jill Dallimore runs a homewares store on Subiaco's retail strip in Perth. Now, this is a well-off inner city suburb with an entertainment precinct and luxury apartments. And even so, Jill says there's been a local downturn.
It's definitely slowed down substantially. Christmas was okay. You always gauge a year by Christmas. It was very slow to start and it was okay. You couldn't say it was terrific. It was okay. And it has been very quiet. It's definitely a downturn.
The latest retail trade data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics shows retail spending is falling fast, with sales of household goods worse affected. Per-person spending is down 3.6% over the last year, as retail volumes drop for the seventh straight quarter, which the ABS says is unprecedented. Jill Dallimore says her trade has dropped at least 15% in the last year, and talk of further rate hikes is worrying.
A lot of my customers still have mortgages, and I'm sure they'll have to cut back somewhere, and I guess new tea towels or a new fry pan might just go. I hope that's not the case, but we'll see. It's a bit frightening.
The central bank lifted its inflation forecast for the rest of the year from 3.2% to 3.8%. AI Group Chief Executive Innes Willicks says conditions are feeling increasingly recessionary for businesses in hospitality and retail.
It's more likely if we're going to see rate movement that it'll be up, not down. And that would be a hammer blow for many businesses who are consumer-facing.
The RBA board still hopes to bring inflation back to the target band of between 2 and 3% by late 2025, though that is increasingly uncertain. Impact Economics and Policy lead economist Angela Jackson says falling retail trade shows that rate hikes are having the intended effect, though spending is coming off a post-pandemic peak.
But is it enough to curb inflation back towards that 2 to 3% band? And that's really, I guess, the million-dollar question.
Many economists expect rates to stay in a holding pattern for the rest of the year, though Angela Jackson says a lower-than-expected jobless rate and the upward pressure that puts on costs for services poses a risk.
So it may well be steady as she goes, but there are still risks, I think, in the economy that the Reserve Bank may see that it's warranted for further rate rises.
Angela Jackson says the upcoming federal budget and the possibility of more government spending could further fuel inflation.
John Daly reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. There have been two knife attacks within just weeks of each other that are being linked to terrorism. Both involved teenage boys. So what's going on? Today, investigative reporter Sean Rubenstein Dunlop on the radicalisation of vulnerable young people. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.